The schooners report no change in their deployment, Admiral, Captain Lathick said, saluting as Admiral Yearly arrived on Destiny's quarterdeck. Not surprising, I suppose, Captain, Yearly replied. A greater degree of formality had crept into his public relationship with Lathick, inevitably, he imagined. Given his new rank, he was now a passenger in Destiny, not her master after God, and it was important he and Lathick made that point clearly for the ship's company. A warship could have only one captain, and any confusion about who that warship's crew looked to for orders in an emergency could be disastrous. I wish they would come out, but obviously no one in Istria is foolish enough to do that, barring direct orders, of course. Lathick nodded, and Yearly's lips quirked briefly. As High Admiral Rockpoint had pointed out, to date, the group of four had been Karras's best allies when it came to naval matters. Rockpoint had hoped, more wistfully than with any great expectation of its happening, that Elaine Maguire might issue Baron Jarras direct, non-discretionary orders to sortie and engage the Imperial Carisian Navy at sea. Apparently, even Maguire had more sense than that, however, unfortunately. Well, the Admiral said now, if they won't come out, we'll just have to go in. Going to be lively, sir, Lathick observed with that irritating pre-battle smile of his, and Yearly shrugged. I suppose that's one way to describe it, he agreed with a smaller, tighter smile of his own. Destiny's motion was a little uneasy as she lay hove to in the middle ground between Silman Island and Ray Island, but that didn't explain Yearly's queasiness. He knew what did cause it, of course. The same odd, hollow feeling, which always afflicted him when battle drew near, was already quivering inside him, and he suppressed a familiar sense of envy as Lathick chuckled in response to his comment. He didn't think Lathick was any less imaginative than he was, but somehow the captain, like so many of Yearly's fellows, seemed impervious to the sort of tension which gripped him at times like this. And even he wasn't all that consistent about it, he thought irritably. It made absolutely no sense for the thought of being splattered across the deck by a cannonball to concern him so much when the thought of drowning in a storm didn't cause him to turn a hair. Well, not much of a hair, anyway. "Signal from Terra, Captain," Midshipman Selkirk called out. He was in the maintop with his enormous spyglass, trained on HMS Terra, Admiral Shane's flagship. "Relayed from Destroyer. Our pendant number, then number 30, number 36, number 55, and number 8." He looked down from the maintop to where Arlie Zones had the signal book open, already finding the signal numbers from the grid. "Make sail on the larboard tack, course south by east, and prepare for battle, sir," the younger midshipman announced after a handful of seconds. "Very good, Master Zones," Lathick said. "Be good enough to acknowledge the signal under the squadron's number." "Aye, aye, sir." Zones was obviously nervous, but he also wore a huge grin as he beckoned to the quarterdeck signal party. "Master Simkey," Lathick continued, turning to the lieutenant who'd become Destiny's executive officer in parallel with his own promotion. "Aye, sir." "Hands to braces, if you please. Prepare to get the ship underway." "Aye, aye, sir. Hands to braces, bosun." "Aye, aye, sir." The signal had scarcely been unexpected, and the colourful bunting had already been spilled out of its canvas bags and bent to the signal halyards. The flags went soaring up while bosun's pipes shrilled and the ship's company went racing to its stations, and Admiral Yearly folded his hands behind him and crossed to the taffrail to gaze astern, while his flag captain and his flagship's crew got about the business of translating High Admiral Rockpoint and Admiral Shane's orders into action. The other five ships of his squadron, HMS Royal Kraken, HMS Victorious, HMS Thunderbolt, HMS Undaunted and HMS Champion also lay hove to, keeping close company on Destiny. And High Admiral Rockpoint had done him proud when he made up the squadron's numbers. Destiny was the oldest and smallest of the six, but all of them were purpose-built war galleons from Corisian yards, not captured prizes or converted merchantmen, and between them they mounted 340 guns. Well found, well handled, and, after the voyage from Tellisburg to Thol Bay to the Gulf of Jaras at least, well drilled, they were a potent force, especially since all of them carried shot lockers full of the new exploding shells. Royal Kraken and Thunderbolt also carried massive 57-pounder carronades, short-ranged compared to the new model Krakens on their gun decks, but capable of throwing much heavier and more destructive shells. The other four carried uniform armaments of 30-pounders, and unlike the Battle of the Markovian Sea, all of his gunners had been given ample opportunity to train with the new ammunition. "Which is a very good thing," he thought dryly, that hollowness in his middle feeling somehow even emptier, "given our part of the battle plan." The wind was a stiff topsail breeze out of the northeast by east, blowing at a speed of perhaps 24 miles per hour and raising 8 to 10 foot waves. On her new heading, Destiny would be sailing large, with the wind almost dead on her quarter. That was just about her best point of sailing, which meant she ought to make a good 7.5 or 8 knots, with just under 30 miles to go. Call it 4 hours, he thought. Time to get all the men fed a good, solid lunch before they cleared for action. And then, "All ships have acknowledged, sir," Sailkirk called from above. "Very good, Master Sailkirk," Lathic called back, then turned respectfully to Yearly. "All ships have acknowledged receipt of the signal, Admiral." "Thank you, Captain," Yearly replied gravely, and glanced up at the stiffly starched signal flags himself. By hoisting the squadron's number above Admiral Shane's signal, Lathic had repeated it to all of the squadron's units. When it was hauled down, Yearly's command would execute it. The rest of the fleet's 16 squadrons would make sail in his wake in succession to execute their own portions of the High Admiral's master plan, and the die would be cast. "My, how dramatic, Duncan," he thought wryly. "The die was cast before you ever left Tellisburg." "Very well, Captain Lathic," he heard himself say calmly. "Execute." Sir Dominic Stainer stood on HMS Destroyer's quarterdeck, watching his flagship's crew scamper about making final preparations. Or that was what he looked like he was doing at any rate. In fact, he was watching the imagery projected on his contact lenses as Duncan Yearly and Peter Shane began to move and the rest of the fleet started unfolding into its own component columns behind them. The Imperial Corisian Navy had returned to the Gulf of Matthias in strength within less than a month of Destiny's damage-enforced retreat. And this time, it hadn't come simply to keep an eye on the exit from the Gulf of Jaras. Admiral Shane had sent his fleet-footed schooners deep into the Gulf to reconnoitre the approaches to Terence Bay, Port Ithria, and Marosa Bay. In the process, they'd swept the once-sheltered waters clear of Desnarian commerce, and taking a page from Rockpoint's own tactics in Thol Bay, Shane had used his marines to seize control of Howard Island, well inside Stefan Reach, and right in the throat of the Howard Passage. The island was barely 35 miles long, and aside from Tern Bay, at its northern end, it didn't present much in the way of decent anchorages. Even Tern Bay was little more than an open roadstead, offering no protection at all against northerlies. Still, it was a source of fresh water, always a warship's most limiting supply factor. It had taken 2 5-days for the heavy naval guns landed across the island's eastern beaches to batter the fortress guarding the small town of Tern Bay into submission. But they'd been time well spent, given how greatly its capture had eased Shane's logistics. The Admiral had also landed enough Marines and enough artillery to make sure no Disneyan punts was going to take it back from him, and suddenly the largely worthless island had become a cork driven firmly into the Disneyan bottle. Operating from the relative security of Tern Bay, the Imperial Carisian Navy had gone basically wherever it chose in the Gulf of Jaras. Rock Point had rather hoped Baron Jaras would venture out to dispute the ICN's invasion of the Disneyan Empire's most economically vital coastal waters. But what had happened to Cornelis Harper had made the Baron wiser than that. So the Carisian cruiser squadrons had amused themselves, wiping out the Gulf's coasting trade and sending cutting-out expeditions into its lesser harbours under cover of darkness to capture or burn anything bigger than a fishing boat. And they'd also trailed their coats just beyond artillery range of the Disneyan Navy's harbour fortifications, counting noses and examining anchorages. As a result, they'd been able to provide Rockpoint with intelligence on his enemy's dispositions, which was almost as good as what Owl Snarks delivered. Not quite, of course, since, unlike the Snarks, they couldn't actually eavesdrop on Jaris's discussions with Coleman or his ship commanders. But they'd provided more than enough information Rockpoint could openly share with his own subordinates for planning purposes. And as he'd studied and discussed those reports with Shane yearly and his other flag officers and senior captains, it had become evident that Jaras realized he simply couldn't fight the Carisian Navy and hope to win. Not at sea, at any rate. Not only that, but somewhat to Rockpoint's surprise, the Baron had demonstrated the moral courage to tell his superiors he couldn't. The Navy of God's shock after the Markovian Sea had been profound enough for those superiors to actually listen to him as well. Or profound enough that they hadn't actively overruled him, at least, when he had turned his galleons into what amounted to no more than floating batteries. Despite the importance of the Gulf's shipping to the Disneyan economy, he hadn't even tried to defend most of its ports either. They'd had to make do with their existing coastal fortifications, which, admittedly, were more than enough to discourage any thought of widespread Carisian landings, especially with the Imperial Disneyan army hanging about just in case it might be needed, because he'd refused to disperse those galleons. Ithria, with its major shipyards and dockyards, was the Gulf's largest and most important harbour, and its primary naval base. It had been built up into a major node in the Church of God shipbuilding and support system, and he had decided he had no choice but to stake everything on protecting his fleet's supporting infrastructure, although even that much was a daunting challenge for a fleet which dared not meet its opponent under sail. Ithria's approaches were screened by an arc of islands, extending from Silman Island to the west, through Singer Island, the most northeasterly outpost of the port city, and then back to Pearl Point on the mainland. That, unfortunately, was a distance of over 150 miles, which was far too long to protect with any sort of fixed defences. Silman Island and Ray Island formed a second theoretical line of defence south of that, but the middle ground, the stretch of water between Silman and Ray, was still 45 miles across, and shallow enough in several spots to offer practical anchorages beyond the range of the island fortress's artillery. South of the middle ground lay the outer roadstead, another 30 miles in a north-south line before one reached the inner harbour and the waterfront proper of Port Ithria. Taken altogether, it was one of the finest anchorages Rock Point had ever seen, and if Desnair hadn't been a primarily land-based power with its attention firmly focused on the Republic of Sidamark and the Harchong Empire, it would have offered a sound base for a thriving merchant marine. Instead, other realms' shipping, primarily Karis, before the current unpleasantness had made use of its potential, which meant, among other things, that Rockpoint's charts for Ithria and its approaches were very, very detailed. The only way to actually reach Ithria from the sea required an attacker to penetrate one of the two openings in the shoals protecting the inner harbour. The West Gate, the passage between Rocky Bank Shoal and Sickle Shoal, was the narrower of those approaches, navigable by small vessels across virtually its entire width at high water. The deep water channel was unfortunately serpentine and relatively narrow, which made it a much more problematical route for blue water galleons. On the other hand, the North Gate, the opening between Sickle Shoal and Triangle Shoal, directly north of the city, was far broader than the West Gate. It was also deeper, with a 12-mile ship channel, navigable even at low water, with nary a twist nor a turn. The Desnarians were well aware of just how wide the door to Ithria's heart was, and they'd built powerful and expensive fortifications on both Sickle Shoal and Triangle Shoal. The masonry forts rose straight out of the water, which put any sort of siege or assault landing out of the question. But the total water gap between them was the better part of 24 miles across, and the maximum reach of their artillery was no more than 3 miles. As part of Jarrus's strategy to emulate a horned lizard and curl up into an armoured ball no one could get at, he had blocked the West Gate by sinking ships and driving pilings into the main shipping channel. Opening it again was going to be an incredible pain, but for now he could be certain no Carisian galleons were going to come sneaking in on him that way. Boat attacks, and possibly even attacks by the shallow-draft schooners at high water, perhaps, but not those deep-draft galleons with their heavy artillery. With the West Gate closed, he had turned his attention to the North Gate and anchored his galleons directly across the ship channel. He had moored them in a long chain, running 12 miles from east to west, with barely 50 yards between each ship and the next in line. Under normal circumstances, the interval would have been 2 or 3 times that great, in order to give the vessels room to ride to their anchors with shifting tide and wind, without fouling one another. Jarrus clearly wasn't particularly worried about that. Besides, each ship had put out no fewer than 2 bow and 2 stern anchors, with springs rigged to each of them. Those ships weren't moving, and he'd laid buoyed hawsers between them as well. According to Al Snarks, each of those cables was a good 10 inches in diameter, and there were 4 of them between each ship. Obviously, they were intended to keep anybody from passing through the narrow gaps Jarrus had left between his galleons. In addition to the galleons, he'd managed to throw together 30 genuine floating batteries, essentially just big rafts with heavy bulwarks. He'd run out of naval artillery, so he'd requisitioned every field piece the Desnarian army could get to Ithria in time, which meant the rafts were armed with an incredible hodgepodge of ancient cannon on every conceivable sort of improvised carriage. Most of them hadn't even been cast with trunnions, although the Ithrian artillery works had been welding banded trunnions onto them as quickly as possible. The battery's fire was going to be a questionable asset, but there were still a lot of them, and he'd anchored them in the shallower water at either end of his line of galleons. Obviously, he intended for them to close as much as possible of the remaining water gap between his ships and the fortifications on Sickle Shoal and Triangle Shoal. Backing up both galleons and floating batteries were 15 or 20 old-fashioned galleys. They didn't have much in the way of artillery, but their job was to lurk on the inner side of the galleon line and to pounce upon and board any Carisian galleon foolhardy enough to force its way between Jarrus's battleships. It was obvious the Baron had paid close attention to the reports he'd received about what had happened in the Markovian Sea. His awareness of the advantage the Carisians' exploding shells bestowed upon them was probably incomplete, but it was clear enough to explain his flat refusal to lead his fleet to sea against Rock Point. And he'd done what he could to protect his ships and batteries against the new threat as well. He had ransacked the entire gulf for every length of chain he could find, and draped it over his galleon sides in an effort to make them at least a little more resistant to shellfire. He didn't have enough of it, and it wasn't heavy enough to stop short-range fire, but it was a clear indication he was at least thinking hard about the threat he faced. The poorly armed floating batteries were actually better protected than his galleons. He'd had their already thick bulwarks fitted with frameworks, which extended 3 or 4 feet. Then he'd filled the frameworks with sandbags. The weight did unfortunate things to the raft's stability and reduced their flotation margins dangerously. But a 4-foot depth of sandbags was far better armour against smoothbore shells than the chain he'd draped down the galleon's sides. Taking everything into consideration, Rock Point had to admit Jarrus' preparations were both more thorough and more competent than he had anticipated. Obviously, the Baron realized that even with exploding shells, the Carisians were still going to have to come into his range if they wanted to engage him. His anchors and springs should allow him to turn his ships in place and concentrate a devastating weight of solid shot on anyone approaching his line. And he had done everything he could to prevent his line from being penetrated and doubled. Nor had he neglected the landward defences. The waterfront batteries had been reinforced. He had drafted entire infantry regiments from the Imperial Desnarian Army to reinforce his marine contingents against the possibility of boarding actions. His decision to fight only from anchor meant he wouldn't need any seamen for manoeuvring, and that every man of every crew would be available to serve his guns. And he had something like 25,000 additional men in Ithria's garrison, from which boats could ferry replacements to his galleons and batteries as they suffered casualties. Yet despite all that, Sir Dominic Stainer truly was as confident as he looked. He didn't expect it to be easy, but then again, few things worth doing were, and he smiled slightly as he recalled a discussion with Prince Narmon. "I have to say I didn't expect Jarrus to put together such a nasty reception for you, Dominic," the little Emeraldian had said over the comm. His tone had been sombre, obviously concerned, but Rockpoint had only chuckled grimly. "He's worked hard at it, I'll give him that," the Admiral had replied. "And given his disadvantages, this is probably about the best plan he could have come up with." "But there's a big difference between best plan he could come up with and a plan with a chance in hell of succeeding, Narmon." "I realize this is your area of expertise, not mine, but it looks ugly enough to me," Narmon had said. "That's because you're not a professional seaman," Rockpoint had shaken his head. "Oh, if we didn't have the exploding shells and Alfred's angle guns, it would be a lot nastier. I'll give you and Jarrus that. But we'd still take him in the end, even with nothing but old-fashioned round-shot. The butcher's bill would be a hell of a lot higher than it's going to be. But we'd still take him." "How can you be so sure?" There'd been only honest curiosity, not disbelief, in Narmon's question, and Rockpoint had shrugged. "A warship is a mobile gun platform, Narmon, and Jarrus doesn't have the kind of experience a Carisian flag officer has. He thinks he's taken mobility out of play, but he's wrong. To a landsman or an army officer, I'm sure his position looks downright impregnable. What a sailor sees, though, are the rat holes in his ramparts, and I mean to shove an entire fleet right through them. That's what I said, Your Highness, he thought now, and that's what I meant. Now to demonstrate how it works. 6. Outer Roadstead and Inner Harbour, Port of Ithria, Empire of Desnair. The guns on Triangle Shoal opened fire first.
Stupid, Sir Duncan Yearley thought. We're still at least a mile out of range, you idiots. Probably the damned army. Even Desnarian naval gunners would know you couldn't hit anything, especially with Desnarian artillery at 4 miles. Still, he had absolutely nothing against watching enemy gunners waste powder and shot. The first, most carefully prepared and aimed salvos were always the most effective, which was the reason most captains reserved their fire until they were close enough they figured they couldn't miss. Of course, fortress guns had the advantage of nice, solid, unmoving firing platforms, which no naval gunner ever had. That was one of the reasons no sane naval commander ever fought a well-sighted, well-protected shore battery. Or that was the way things used to be, at any rate. Carisian galleons had successfully out-dueled masonry-protected harbour defences at Delphrac, after all. Still, even the majority of Carisian naval officers regarded that as something of a fluke, which it undoubtedly had been. For one thing, the rickety fortifications in question had been in less than perfect condition. Indeed, some of them had been about ready to fall down on their own. More importantly, however, Admiral Rockpoint had confronted old-style military with a rate of fire less than a quarter than that of his own, and he had had the advantage of total surprise. Not surprise at being attacked, but astonishment, and probably sheer disbelief, at the sheer volume of fire his ships had been able to produce. That particular surprise no longer applied, and judging by the rapidity with which the Triangle Shoal Fortress was pumping out round shot, it had been equipped with updated artillery as well. If those shore gunners had modern guns, on modern carriages, and were using bagged charges, then the stability of their footing should actually allow them to serve their pieces even more rapidly than the Carisian gunners could. On the other hand, there's a difference between rapid fire and effective fire, Yearley reminded himself. Blazing away and not hitting anything is just a more spectacular way to accomplish absolutely nothing, and anybody who's going to open fire at this range is unlikely to be the most accurate gunner in the world, at any range. He stood on Destiny's quarterdeck, hands once more clasped behind him, feet spread, shoulders deliberately relaxed, and concentrated on looking calm. I wonder if one reason I'm feeling so smug about the standard of Desnarian gunnery in general is that gloating over what lousy shots they are is one way of reassuring myself that they're not going to hit anything, like me. The thought made him chuckle, and he shook his head at his own perversity, then looked at Lathic. The captain was bent over the binnacle, taking a compass bearing on the smoke-spurting fortress. Then he straightened and glanced up at the masthead weather vane with a thoughtful frown. "Well, Captain?" "I make it about another mile and a half before we alter towards them, sir. Perhaps 30 more minutes." Yearley turned to gaze over the bulwarks, considering angles and rates of movement, then nodded. "I believe you're right, Captain. I think it's time to make the signal to Captain Raswell." "Aye, sir. I'll see to it." Yearley nodded again, then looked around at the unfolding panorama. At least all the men who were about to die had been given a lovely day on which to do it. The sky was a deep, perfect blue,
with only the lightest scattering of high-altitude cloud, and the water was a gorgeous blend of blues and greens, creaming in white under the galleon's 4 feet in the early afternoon sunlight. The seabirds and sea wyverns who had followed the Corisian galleons, swooping and bobbing as they hoped for garbage in the ship's wakes, seemed confused by the sudden rolling bursts of thunder on such a perfect day. They were circling away from the ships, although they didn't really seem panicked yet. On the other hand, they were probably bright enough to realize that what was about to happen was none of their business. The rest of his squadron forged along in Destiny's wake, and astern of them was a moving forest of masts and canvas, weathered to all different shades of grey and tan and dirty white. The Imperial Standard flew from mastheads throughout the fleet. Some of the more enthusiastic captains had one at each masthead, and the long, thin, colourful tongues of flag officers' command streamers blew from mizzen masts for rear admirals and commodores, from main masts for admirals, and from foremasts for the newly introduced rank of vice-admiral. Up until the last year or two, Yearly couldn't have imagined seeing that many ships in one place, all bent on a single mission under the command of a single admiral. Even now, the sheer magnitude of the spectacle seemed preposterous. He couldn't pick Destroyer out of the mass of her consorts, but she was back there, sailing along in the middle of that huge sprawl, rather than leading the way as he knew High Admiral Rockpoint would have preferred. But that exposed position wasn't the proper place for a High Admiral, not in something like this. No, that was more properly left to a more expendable flag officer, like one Sir Duncan Yearly. "The signal to Captain Raswell is ready, sir," Ensign Applin Armack said respectfully, and Yearly gave himself a shake. "Very well, Master Applin Armack. Let's get it sent," the Admiral said with a crooked smile. "And then I think we should probably signal the squadron to reduce sail, don't you think?" "They don't seem very impressed by General Starkhale's gunnery, my lord," Captain Malik Alvey observed dryly. "No, they don't, Captain," Baron Jarras agreed. They stood on the poop deck of HMS Emperor George, Jarrah's 48-gun flagship. Unlike the majority of the Desnarian Navy, Emperor Zorj was a purpose-built war galleon with much heavier framing and planking than her converted merchant consorts. Despite that, she was considerably smaller and more lightly armed than the ship sailing steadily towards her. Jarrah's had strongly considered remaining in his shoreside office, with access to the semaphore and the signal flag mast on top of the main dockyard building, he'd actually have been better able to send orders from there, at least until smoke obscured all signals, especially with Emperor Zorge's masts truncated because of his orders to send topmasts and topgallant masts ashore. It would also have been considerably safer in a personal sense. But while Jarrah's had steadfastly avoided combat with the Imperial Corisian Navy, there was nothing wrong with his personal courage. If his fleet had to fight, his proper place was with it, and from a somewhat more cynical and calculating perspective, he was more likely to avoid condemnation for the debacle about to occur if he could point out to Vicar Alain and Vicar Zaspar that he had commanded from the front, in the very heart and fury of the action. He didn't know how much more likely to avoid condemnation he might be, but anything was worth striving for. At the moment, however, he could only endorse Captain Alvey's opinion. General Larry Starkhale, the commanding officer of the Triangle Shoal Fortress, had not been Jarrah's choice for his job. He could think of at least a half-dozen officers he would have preferred to see commanding that fort, but Starkhale had friends at court and a reputation, mostly self-bestowed, as an artillerist. Jarrah's had never seen any evidence he deserved it, although, to be fair, he was an army artillerist, not a naval gunner. not that the Baron was interested in being any fairer to Starkhale than he had to be at the moment. He raised his telescope and picked up the white floors of round shots skipping across the waves. Perhaps Starkhale was trying to ricochet the shot into the ships, extending his range by bouncing the projectiles the way an artillerist could sometimes do on land. If so, he didn't seem to be succeeding.
"You really should be at least a little fair, Irwin," he told himself. "There's not much chance the Carisians are going to come into his range. If he wants to hit them at all, he's going to have to do it from a long way away."
Unfortunately, Starkhale's enthusiasm seemed to be contagious, and some of the floating batteries closest to Triangle Shoal were beginning to fire sporadically as well. Their guns were much closer to the water, giving them even less range than the fortress, and he lowered the glass with an angry grimace.
"Signal to the floating batteries, if you please, Captain," he snapped. "Cease fire. Do not waste powder and shot."
"Aye, my lord," Alvey replied, then cleared his throat.
Should I address the signal to General Starkhale as well, sir?" "By no means, Captain." Jarris actually managed to smile. "First, he's got a lot more powder in his magazines than any of the batteries do. Second, I don't think he quite grasps that the Navy is in charge of Ithria's defence. There seems to be some confusion in his mind as to the exact structure of the chain of command. And I'd hate to overtax his clearly overworked brain trying to explain it to him in the middle of a battle."
"I see, my lord." Alvey seemed to be having a little difficulty keeping his voice level, Jarris observed. "Well, it wasn't as if his opinion of Starkhale should come as any surprise to his own flag captain, although he supposed he really shouldn't be throwing more fuel on that particular fire." The captain turned away, his shoulders quivering with what certainly looked like suppressed laughter, and beckoned to his signal lieutenant. Jarras watched Alvey for a moment or two, then turned back to the oncoming Carisians as they began reducing sail.
"Stripping down to fighting sail," he thought. "Langhorne, I hope you and Chihiro are both keeping an eye on us down here, because I think we're going to need you."
Sir Duncan Yearley had little attention to spare for the line of anchored galleons and floating batteries, even though that was his own squadron's immediate objective. He was too busy watching Captain Aldous Raswail's ship and her half-dozen sisters. HMS Volcano was an odd-looking vessel. She was actually larger than Destiny. Although she was rated at only 24 guns and showed only 12 ports on a side, and all of her guns were mounted on the spar deck, which put her ports a good 20 feet above her designed waterline. Her bulwarks were higher than most galleons, and the ports piercing them were disproportionately tall as well. She was disproportionately beamy and massive-looking, too, although that was less evident, watching her in profile the way Yearley was at the moment. There was a reason for her odd appearance, and also a reason she'd been built at King's Harbour, rather than one of the more publicly accessible yards the Navy was using for the majority of its construction these days. No one had wanted anyone getting a close look at her or her sisters and wondering about their peculiarities. In fact, even though Yearley had seen Volcano herself on the waves, he'd never noticed most of the unusual features of her design until they'd been pointed out to him by High Admiral Rockpoint. The reason she carried so few guns was that each of the ones she did carry weighed more than twice as much as one of the new model Krakens on Destiny's gun deck. Despite that, the gun tubes looked short and stubby, and their carriages looked downright bizarre. Not too surprisingly, he supposed, since each of those guns had a 10-inch bore, and those ridiculous tall carriages were designed specifically to permit them to be elevated to absurd heights. That had required some tricky engineering, particularly given the recoil forces involved. The mammoth guns took either a 150-pound solid shot or a 100-pound shell, and the stresses when one of them fired were extreme. The downward thrust, engendered by their high elevations, had to be absorbed by the ship's deck, which helped to explain Volcano's extraordinarily massive frames and thick deck planking. All war galleons were basically mobile gun platforms, but Volcano and her sisters took it to ridiculous extremes. That had been Yearly's initial reaction, at any rate. Before he had sailed to join Admiral Shane, however, he'd had the opportunity to exercise with Captain Raswail's squadron, and he was rather looking forward to sharing that experience with the Desnarians. That's odd, Baron Jarrus thought, watching the half-dozen or so galleons which had peeled off from the rest of the advancing line. It was obviously a planned and deliberate manoeuvre. The meticulous order the Carizians were maintaining as they advanced to battle was sobering, for someone who'd tried to get his own fleet organized to at least all sail in approximately the same direction on the same day. It had proven to be an exercise all too like trying to herd cat lizards, but those galleons were manoeuvring with the kind of precision and discipline for which Desnarian cavalry was famed. Given Jarrus' unhappy experiences with his own fleet, he had altogether too good an appreciation for how difficult that was. Despite the vast size of the fleet sailing towards him, there was no sign of confusion anywhere in that mountain range mass of canvas and masts, which had made the antics of the ships which had caught his eye even more perplexing. Instead of bearing away from Triangle Shoal, they were actually headed for it, and he realized they had cutters and longboats out in front, taking soundings with lead lines to determine the depth of the water. "No," he realized as one of the longboats put a buoy over the side. "They're running lines of soundings, matching them with the depths on their charts to help determine their exact positions. But why? And that buoy is inside Starkhale's extreme range. He's not likely to hit anything on purpose, but if they anchor that close in and he fires enough shots, blind, dumb luck is likely to give him a chance to hurt them after all." It made no sense. There was no need for them to enter the play of Starkhale's guns. Perhaps not, yet that was clearly what they had in mind. In fact, as he watched, the first galleon dropped a stern anchor. Her companions continued onward, and then a second ship anchored by the stern as well, then a third, a fourth. They were actually anchoring, forming a line and making themselves unmoving targets. And Jarrus frowned in disbelief as he realized they had springs on their anchor cables. They were deliberately courting an artillery duel with heavy fortress guns protected by thick masonry walls. Thin white waterspouts began to pock the surface of the waves around the anchored Carizians, but they went calmly about the business of taking in sail. Then they began adjusting their positions, using the springs to wind themselves around until they presented their broadsides directly to Starkhale's fortress. They seemed in no hurry, almost as if they were unaware of the plumes of smoke rising from the furnaces Starkhale was using to heat his round shot until they glowed cherry red. One or two of those heated shot, lodged in a ship's timbers, could turn it into an inferno, yet they appeared unconcerned by the possibility. What kind of madman?
"All guns cleared away and prepared to fire, sir,"
Aldous Raswail's executive officer informed him.
"Elevation, 35 degrees.
"Very well, Master Burke. You may open fire."
Baron Jarrus' fingers tightened convulsively on the barrel of his spyglass as the first of the galleons fired. He could actually see the trajectory of their shot, and the arched, impossibly high, lofting across the blue sky in a delicate arc that took them over the top of the fortress curtain wall and dropped straight into its interior. And then they exploded. Aldous Raswail smiled in satisfaction as Volcano's first broadside slammed into its target. He couldn't see it actually hit, but that was rather the point of the exercise, and his smile turned into a fierce, savage grin as the shells exploded inside the fortress. Raswail had had his doubts when Commander Mandrain first approached him, but he had known Mandrain for several years. He'd respected the younger man's brain power, and Baron Seamount was recognized as the Navy's premier gunnery expert. When both of them insisted Seamount's new high-angle gun was a practical proposition, he'd agreed to become one of the officers involved in developing it as a workable weapon. It was obvious to him that the current high-angle guns, which Volcano's crew had already shortened to angle gun, or even just angles for day-to-day use, were only a crude, very early development of what would one day be possible. On the other hand, the entire Carisian Navy had grown accustomed to being a work in progress. Looking back at the breakneck rate of change involved in the conversion from a fleet of 200 galleys to an equally large fleet of gun-armed galleons in less than 5 years was enough to make a man's head spin. And there was no reason to suppose anything was going to change in that regard, whatever the Grand Inquisitor might have preferred. Mondrain's death had been a tragedy in more ways than Raswail could count. The commander had been exactly the sort of brilliant innovator the Carisian Empire needed if it was going to survive. Raswail himself wasn't in the same league, and he knew it, yet he'd also realized he was going to have to step up to the plate and try anyway. He'd already started working on a couple of rough ideas for a proper rotating gun mount, although he was pretty sure it would have to wait for those iron-framed ships Mandrain had been talking about. And making it work with all the masts and spars in the way was going to be a challenge as well. But once they'd managed to rifle the angle guns, figured out how to lengthen the tubes further, and gotten them into a pivot mount that could stand the recoil, possibly figured out a way to make breech-loading work, then... For now, though, crude though they might be, Volcano's guns were doing exactly what they'd been designed to do. He turned his back on the fortress. Any hit it managed to score would be a matter of pure luck. Not only that, but Volcano had been built with scantlings which were almost twice the thickness of a standard galleon, and not just to resist the recoil of her own guns. Those thick sides should be the next best thing to invulnerable, even to fortress guns at such extreme range. The same, alas, could not be said for fortress walls where her guns were concerned. Given their sheer size, those guns would have made highly effective battering pieces in a traditional siege, hurling their 150-pound round shot against those masonry walls again and again, and the fortifications protecting Ithria were old-fashioned masonry, without the shot-absorbing earthen berms which improvements in artillery had imposed on modern fortress designers. They would have shattered quickly under the sort of pounding Volcano could have given them. But why pound your way through a wall when you could simply ignore it instead? He watched the gun crews reloading. It was an inevitably slow process, although he and Mandrain had done what they could to improve matters. The upper portion of the carriage was a separate structure which recoiled on skids cut into the lower wheeled carriage. The lower portion was fitted with casted wheels that ran on iron rails set into the deck, arranged so that the entire piece could be pushed around in train, in calm weather at least, by only two men, despite its massive weight. When the upper portion of the slide carriage recoiled, it did so in an angled plane, which brought the elevated muzzle closer to parallel to the deck. It was still inconveniently high for the members of the gun crew responsible for swabbing out and reloading, but it was workable. And it meant they didn't have to depress the barrel and then re-elevate it between every shot. It was all still clumsy, and the rate of fire was far slower than a standard long 30-pounder's, but Raswell was trying to come up with a better way to manage things. It all went back to breech-loading, he thought again. If they could ever get that to work. Despite all their handicaps, Volcano's gunners managed to sustain a rate of fire which was almost twice that of the old pre-bagged charge and pre-truck gun carriage days. As he watched, fresh powder bags slid down the barrels and were rammed home, followed by shells strapped to stabilizing shoes. The shoes, flat wooden discs the same diameter as the shells, fixed the shells' attitude in relation to the angle gun's bores and made sure their fuses faced away from the powder charges. They also made the shells easier to handle, which was nothing to sneer at when the things weighed 100 pounds each. The fuses were a significant improvement on Baron Seamount's original design, too. The new fuses burned much more consistently, and they could be adjusted for more finicky time increments. It was still something of a by-guess-and-by-Langhorne endeavour, but it was less a matter of guesstimating than it had been, and a little spread in detonation times wasn't going to matter much. They were dropping their fire at steep angles into the fortress interior, and those same masonry walls were going to confine the shells and their blast right on top of the target. Not only that, but no fortress designer in the world had ever considered ways to deal with plunging fire like this. The interior of that fortress had no overhead protection at all, because it had never been needed before. Jarrah's jaw clenched as the volume of thoroughly useless fire from Triangle Shoal dropped abruptly. The peculiar Carisian galleons were staggering their fire in an obviously pre-planned fashion. Their steady, rolling broadsides were timed to see to it that at least one ship's shells went plunging into the fortress every few seconds. They were maintaining a cauldron of explosions inside the fort. No wonder Starkhale's fire was dropping. How, in Shan Wei's name, had even Carisians come up with... The question chopped off with axe-like suddenness as the fortress main magazine exploded. Raswell's eyes widened as the fortress suddenly emulated Volcano's namesake. That was unexpected. The plan had been simply to drive the gun crews off their pieces, and possibly disable the guns themselves, not to blow up the damned fortress. Damn! They must have had even less overhead protection than we expected, he thought, with an odd sense of detachment, as he watched stonework, pieces of heavy wooden beams, an entire gun carriage and cannon, and undoubtedly bits and pieces of men, launch themselves across the heavens, trailing comet tails of smoke as they arced outward. They seemed to hang at the tops of their trajectories for a long moment, and then they came plunging down into the water in explosions of white, and Raswell shook his head. Looks like we're going to have to introduce some additional new ideas in fortress design, he thought as a sizable piece of one fortress wall pitched wearily outward and slid down into a white cauldron of foam. I wonder how deep we'll have to bury a magazine to keep a 10-inch shell from reaching it. And if rifled shells are as much heavier as Baron Seamount is predicting, how deep will we have to go to protect against one of them? He had no idea what the answer to either of those questions might be, but he made a mental note to discuss it with Baron Seamount at his earliest opportunity. It was only going to be a matter of time before the other side figured out how to build its own angle guns, after all. When that happened, it would probably be a good idea for Karis to be ahead of the defensive game as well.
"'Be so good as to send a boat close enough to the fortress to hail it, Master Burke,' he said out loud, showing his first lieutenant a bared teeth grin, as shells continued to plunge into the target, and the smoke of heavy fires came belching up from its interior to join the smoke and dust plume of the explosions still lingering above it. "'I imagine they might be in the mood to consider surrendering, don't you?'
"'Well, that's a thing, Sir Duncan,' Robert Lathic murmured, gazing back at the smoke-gushing fortress. "'Can't say as I expected that.'
"'I don't think anyone did,' Yearly replied almost absently. "'Still, I'm not going to complain.'
"'Oh, not me either, sir,' Lathic grinned. "'Matter of fact, if it takes a little starch out of those lads in front of us, I'll be just delighted.'
His flag captain had a point, Yearly thought. His squadron had slowly altered course, coming around to a heading of approximately east by south, almost, but not quite parallel to the line of Baron Jarrus's anchored galleons. They were closing only slowly now under topsails and jib alone, and here and there a Desnarian gun was beginning to thud in defiance. None of those shots were coming anywhere near destiny, yet. But as the range continued to fall, that was likely to change.
"'Very well, Captain Lathic,' he said. "'I believe it's time.'
"'Aye, aye, sir,' Lathic nodded, and raised his speaking trumpet. "'Man, the braces!'
Baron Jarrus was still staring at Triangle Shoal when he heard the bellow of fresh gunfire coming from the west. At first he thought the Carisian galleons approaching his line had opened fire, but then he realized his mistake. Somewhere beyond his line of sight, another cluster of those damned bombardment galleons, or whatever the hell someone wanted to call them, had opened fire on the Sickleshoal fortress as well. That was too far away for Jarrus to see from his current position. But off the top of his head, he couldn't think of any reason for that fortress to be any more successful than Starkale's had been. He stamped to the forward edge of the poop deck, raising his spyglass and peering through it. From this close to the water, he couldn't actually see the fortress thanks to the curve of the earth, but he could make out the clouds of gunsmoke rising beyond Sickle Shoal. He knew it was pointless, but he was still trying to pick out some sort of detail when Captain Alvai cleared his throat.
"'Beg pardon, my lord, but it seems the heretics are about to come calling.'
Jarrus lowered the glass and looked across Emperor Zorge's starboard rail, and his expression tightened. The leading Carisian squadron had turned downwind once more, sailing directly into his anchored ship's broadsides. He had enough of an angle on them to see their rigged anchors and realize they, too, intended to anchor by the stern, undoubtedly on a spring. With the wind setting steadily out of the northeast, and the tide making wind and current alike, would help them maintain their positions. There wasn't much subtlety to it, he thought harshly. A straight broadside duel, a pounding match. One he ought to be able to win, even if his guns were lighter, because he could bring so many more of them to bear. Except for the minor fact that unless he was sadly mistaken, every one of those galleons was about to begin firing the same sort of ammunition which had just blown the guts out of a heavy masonry fortress. And we're just a tiny bit more likely to catch fire or sink than a fortress. A mental voice told him.
"'Open fire, Captain Alvai,' he said flatly.
7. Inner Harbour, Port of Ithria, Empire of Desnair. The afternoon tore apart in thunder, lightning, smoke, and screams. HMS Destiny had missed the savage battle in the Markovian Sea, but she made up for it now. The Imperial Desnarian Navy was nowhere near the equal of the Navy of God. Its crews had less training, most of them had less motivation, and although their artillery had been manufactured to the same design, there was an enormous difference in its workmanship and quality.
Most of Baron Jarrus's captains refused to load their guns with full charges, given their propensity to explode unexpectedly, and the gun crews, who tended to have a closer association with them, were even more leery of their weapons. Worse, Jarrus had been more or less forced to settle for dry-firing their pieces for training, since he couldn't afford to use them up before they were actually needed in battle. His gunners had mastered the motions of their drill, but it was a largely theoretical mastery, without the experience of the actual thunder of their weapons, the reek of smoke, and, certainly, without a live enemy on the far side of the gunport from them. On the other hand, there were a lot of guns on those Desnarian ships, and Jarrus's galleons had been in place literally for months. His crews might be nowhere near the equal of their Carisian opponents as seamen, but then very few seamen were. And the Desnarians might not have the Carisians' tradition of victory because, again, very few navies did. But what those Desnarian crewmen did have was practice and complete familiarity with their commander's battle plan. And while they might not have mastered the gunner's trade and the brimstone reek of actual burned gunpowder, the motions of the evolution had been drilled into them mercilessly. They knew exactly what they were supposed to do, because their captains had explained it to them in detail, and they'd practiced it over and over again. And if their fire might not be as accurate or as rapid as their opponents, it was far more accurate and rapid than it would have been at sea, manoeuvring under sail while the ship moved and surged underfoot. The crewmen assigned to the capstans had spent literally 5 days practicing turning their ships, pivoting them to exactly the angles their captains wanted, and they did that now. As the Carisian line, led by HMS Destiny, headed for its enemies, a hailstorm of white splashes rose all about Sir Duncan Yearley's flagship and her consorts. It wasn't well aimed, but there was so much of it, not all of it could miss, and heavy, splintering sounds announced the arrival of 12-pound and 25-pound round shot. They slammed into Destiny's bow as she headed straight into the line of Jarrus-anchored galleons, and Hector Aplin Armach saw one of his ship's long 14-pounder bow chasers take a direct hit. Its carriage disintegrated, spewing out a fan of splinters that wounded 3 men at other guns. Half its own crew was killed by the hit, and one of the survivors was down, kicking in agony on the deck while the fingers of his right hand tried vainly to staunch the bleeding where his left arm had been. 2 members of the same gun crew, who seemed to be unhurt, grabbed their maimed companion and started dragging him towards the hatch and the waiting heelers. Just as another broadside lashed the water around the ship and another round shot ripped through all 3 of them. This time, there were no survivors. The ensign turned away, looking for his admiral, and saw Captain Lathick standing on top of the starboard hammock nettings, 1 arm through the mizzen shrouds for balance, while he leaned out, trying to fix the Desenarian's position in his mind, despite the solid wall of smoke their guns were belching out. As Aplin Armach watched, another Desenarian round shot came whimpering and whining out of the thunder. It slammed through the hammock nettings less than 3 feet from the captain, and a flying splinter cut a deep gash in his right cheek. But Lathick didn't even seem to notice. He only leaned farther out, as if he thought he could somehow bend down and look under the smoke, between it and the water, to see his enemy clearly. Sir Duncan stood beside the binnacle, hands still clasped behind him, his head moving steadily back and forth as his gaze swept between Captain Lathick and the masthead weather vane. Silvest Regley stood 2 paces behind him, head cocked, watching the chaos as if he were considering how best to arrange seating for a formal dinner. Stewart Malik stood on the admiral's other side, arms folded, head settled well down on his neck, while he chewed a wad of chew leaf with the air of someone who had seen this sort of nonsense altogether too often. Yearley seemed unaware of his henchman's presence, His expression was calm, almost contemplative, as he glanced briefly down at the binnacle compass card, and Aplin Armagh drew a deep breath. It wasn't as if he'd never seen battle before, he reminded himself, remembering the thunder of guns, the screams, the clash of steel on steel from the Battle of Dacor Sound. But there was a difference this time, he realized. For the first time, he wasn't truly part of Destiny's company. He was Admiral Yearley's flag lieutenant, with no assigned battle station, no responsibility to the ship that he could grasp in mental hands and cling to when the world went mad around him. He couldn't believe what an enormous difference that made, and yet, as the recognition struck him, he also realized it had to be even worse for the Admiral. Like Aplin Armagh, Yearley was only a passenger this time. The man who'd commanded Destiny, who'd been ultimately responsible for every order given aboard her, found himself with absolutely no decision to make once the order to engage had been given. The youthful ensign stepped up beside his admiral. Malik saw him coming and grinned, then spat an expert jet of brown tulip juice over the leeward rail. Yearley, alerted by his coxswain's grin, turned his own head, looking at the ensign, and raised one eyebrow as yet another salvo of roundshot ploughed the water around his flagship.
"Lively, I believe the captain predicted, sir."
Aplin Armagh had to speak loudly to be heard through the tumult.
"A sometimes surprisingly apt way with words, the captain has," Yearley replied with a nod. "Exactly what I was thinking myself, sir," Aplin Armagh managed to smile. "Except, I think it's going to get even more lively shortly."
"One can only hope, Master Aplin Armagh," Yearley said. "One can only hope."
Baron Jarrus coughed as incredibly foul-smelling gun smoke rolled back across Emperor Zorge's decks. Hard as he'd tried to prepare himself, he'd never imagined anything like this ear-crushing din. The sheer concussion of hundreds of pieces of artillery, the bubbles of overpressure spreading out when they fired, was unimaginable. He felt the surges of air pressure coming back, punching at his face like immaterial fists, reeking of Shan Wei's own brimstone come hot from hell, and the deck planking underfoot shook to the recoil of his flagship's guns like a terrified animal. Yet for all the thunder and fury, the range from Emperor Zorge to her enemies was longer than Jarrus had expected, and her fire was proportionately less accurate as a result. The northeasterly wind swept diagonally across his east-to-west line of anchored ships, rolling the smoke before it. It blew back into his eyes, but he could still make out the Carisian mastheads above the fog bank borne of his own artillery, and something like a chill ran down his spine as he watched those implacable mastheads, the ones which had maintained their distance as they approached his line on an almost parallel course in a long loop from the east, turn suddenly towards it.
"They have to be out of their minds," he thought. "Langhorn, they're sailing straight into our broadsides."
He had never anticipated that. Sailed directly into an opponent's fire, on a heading which let every one of their broadside's guns bear where none of yours would. Madness! Yet that was precisely what the Carisians were doing, and that chill in his spine grew colder and stronger as he realized why. As he watched, the first six ships in the Carisian line headed directly for the six easternmost galleons in his own line. They weren't going to sail along his line, exchanging broadsides with him, after all. Had their earlier heading been nothing but a bluff to make him think they would? He didn't know, but whether they deliberately tried to deceive him or not was immaterial now. Their new course wouldn't allow him to concentrate the fire of multiple ships on each of theirs as they moved into position as he had planned. Instead, each of those ships was deliberately taking the fire of its own clearly pre-selected target end-on in order to close the range far more rapidly than Jarrus had ever expected.
They're going to come to the range they want. Then they're going to anchor, and then they're going to pound the ever-living hell out of the end of my line, he realized sickly. They're going to get hurt doing it, but they're also going to blow a gap. The ships behind them will be able to sail straight through.
He watched those mastheads coming on unflinchingly, knew those ships had to be taking dozens of hits, and recognized that it didn't matter. More and more round shot smashed into Destiny's sturdy hull. Many of them, especially from the lighter 12-pounders, failed to penetrate, although no one aboard the Carisian ship realized that was partly because the Desnarian gunners were firing with reduced charges because they distrusted their own artillery. Even with the understrength charges, however, the 25-pounders were another matter. Aplin Armach heard splintering crashes and the screams of wounded men from the crews on the gun deck's long 30-pounders as those heavier shot punched through, and a 4-foot section of Destiny's midship's bulwark exploded inward in a tornado of splinters and shredded hammocks. Then,
"Heads below! Main top gallants coming adrift!"
The Admiral and the Ensign looked up in time to see the entire main top gallant yard shot clean through right at the slings begin its fall. The two halves of the yard slipped downward, then plunged like broken javelins, still joined by the shredded remnants of the sail. The braces, secured to the ends of the yard, stopped it before it actually hit the nettings stretched over the deck to protect against falling debris, and it dangled untidily, swinging like an ungainly pendulum in a tangle of canvas, broken wood, and cordage.
"Get aloft and secure that wreckage!"
Bosun Simmons bellowed, and men went swarming up the rigging to capture and tame that pendulum before it could plunge the rest of the way to the deck with lethal consequences.
"Stand by to anchor," Captain Lethick shouted. "Hands to bunt lines and clue lines. Stand by the larboard broadside."
Seamen moved through the smoke and the turmoil with disciplined haste. The crews of the larboard guns crouched down, getting as much out of the way as they could. With only topsails and jib set, Destiny needed only a fraction of the men normally required to make or take in sail, which was just as well under the circumstances, Aplin Armach reflected. At least 5 of the galleon's larboard guns had already been knocked out of action. Her decks were splashed with blood. He saw at least 12 bodies lying where they'd been dragged out of their mate's way, and casualties were piling up at the heeler's station on the orlop deck.
"Larboard your helm!" the captain shouted. "Take in 4 and main topsail!"
Destiny turned to starboard as the wheel went over, presenting her waiting larboard broadside to the Desnarian galleon HMS St. Adolfo, the 5th ship in from the eastern end of Jarrus Line.
"Let go the larboard anchor!"
The sheet anchor rigged from the larboard cathead was released. It plunged instantly, but this time the cable was flaked out on the gun deck, not the upper deck, and run not from the hawse hole but through a stern gun port. The galleon continued past the point at which the anchor had been dropped under her jib alone, sailing out her cable, while the men on the gun deck stayed carefully out of the way of the thick hawser rumbling and roaring out the gun port. Then the cable hit the stoppers, halting its run, and Destiny shuddered and jerked as the anchor's flukes dug into the bottom and held. The cable snapped taut, and Chief Quayle and his waiting party pounced, nipping the bitter end of the spring to it.
"Made fast!"
The call came up from below, and Lathic nodded.
"Take in the jib. Veer the cable, Master Simke. Take tension on the spring."
Captain Ernesto Plysik of the Imperial Desnarian Navy watched the Carisian galleon stop moving. She edged a bit further to windward under bare spars as her topsails were brailed up and her jib dropped, and his stomach muscles tensed. She was veering a little more cable, he realized, and when she finished, she'd have the slack she needed for the spring she'd undoubtedly rigged to control her heading, just as the springs on his own anchors controlled St. Adolfo's. And when that happened... "Pound her, boys!" he bellowed, jabbing his sword like a pointer at the Carisian half-obscured by his own gunsmoke. "If you want to live, pound that bitch!"
"Stand by the larboard battery!" Lieutenant Timkin shouted.
A hurricane of round-shot hammered his ship. Although only HMS Loyal Defender, St. Adolfo's next ahead, was able to turn to lend her guns to St. Adolfo's defence. Holy Langhorne, astern of St. Adolfo, might have assisted her as well, but she no longer had any attention to spare. Captain Bardanes, Undaunted, had fetched up to windward of her, and Timkin heard the thunder of Undaunted's artillery as the other galleon came into action. Still, between them, St. Adolfo's and Loyal Defender's broadsides mounted 44 guns to Destiny's 25, or what would have been 25 if she hadn't been so heavily hit on the way in. In fact, she probably had no more than 18 or 19 guns, and Timkin peered through the smoke, waiting for the spring to bring her fully around. He wasn't going to waste that first broadside by firing 1 second before he was sure all of his guns bore on the target. And the 12-pound shot from St. Adolfo's starboard battery struck Destiny's youthful third lieutenant just below mid-chest and tore his body in two. Aplin Armach saw Timkin flung aside in a spray of blood and torn flesh. At almost the same instant, he realized Travis Sailkirk, Timkin's assistant in command of the larboard battery, was down as well, wounded or dead, he couldn't tell. Up until his elevation to Admiral Yearley's flag lieutenant, that had been Aplin Armach's duty station when the ship cleared for action, and old reflexes took over. He didn't stop to think. He simply acted, leaping up onto the larboard gangway. His feet slid in Timkin's fresh blood, despite the sand scattered over the decks for traction, and he clutched at the main shrouds for balance to keep himself from falling.
"As you bear, lads!" he screamed, then waited two more heartbeats. "Fire!"
St. Adolfo heaved, as another broadside blasted out of her smoke-streaming gun muzzles. And there was a sharper, louder report from forward, as her number three gun blew up despite the reduced charge. Fortunately, the gun tube simply split lengthwise. Half its crew was killed, the ready charges being brought up for it, and the number four gun were touched off in sympathetic detonation by the flame gushing from the shattered cannon, wounding four more men. But it could have been worse. Indeed, it had been worse the last time one of St. Adolfo's guns burst. But that didn't change the fact that it had burst, and at the worst possible time, Captain Plysik thought bitterly. The entire forward half of his starboard battery was thrown into confusion by the sudden and fully understandable terror a bursting gun always produced.
"More hands to the forward guns!" he shouted. "Let's get some fresh..."
The Carisian galleon fired at last.